Hello, I'm Jackie Jordan. This is number 0208, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0208. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, a visit with memory expert Dave Farrow, who talks about, among other things, the Summer Dumber Syndrome.
The science has actually confirmed that kids actually get lazier and dumber over the summer. That part is obvious, we all know that, but we actually found that it actually affects their grades going into the fall. Students can decline as much as an entire letter grade if they don't do a couple of things over the summer. And actually, parents can be part of the problem or part of the solution. A couple of little things that I'm going to tell you during this interview will show parents things that they can do to prevent their kids from falling behind in the fall because they got lazy over the summer.
Veronica Gray is also known as the Surf Lady. She dispels some myths about sharks.
One of the big ones I like to talk about is that sharks don't really have good sight, that they only can sense blood in the water, and that's not at all true. First of all, sharks' vision is 20 times more powerful than that of humans.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and we're going to the moon on Book Banter. Well, sort of, with the Astronaut Wives Club and some other blast-off recommendations. So the countdown is on. It's T-minus several minutes on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0208, was Jackie Jordan, who is a film and TV producer. Her company, TV Guestpert, has been responsible for booking great guests on shows all across North America, including some of the guests that have appeared right on this show, the Stuff File program, including Jackie herself, who in the past has been a guest on the Stuff File program. Her work is indeed inspirational and a lot of help to many people who book shows just like this. And for that, I thank Jackie for the work she does, and also thank her for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, police responded to calls to the Capitol Hill area of Seattle, Washington, to find a man rolling around the street in an office chair. According to police reports, the man was holding a set of drumsticks, had a hubcap tied to his arm, and was wearing motorcycle goggles and several scarves and purses. He allegedly explained to officers that he was, quote, late for a gig, unquote. The man allegedly then gave a false name and told the officers to cuff him, which, of course, they did. He then rolled back into the street and had to be caught again. This time, the man allegedly spat at them and said that it was a warning shot. After they finally had the man in custody, they searched him and found a 12-inch crowbar, along with a belt buckle and necklace stuffed into his gloves. He was taken to hospital for mental health evaluations. Yes, he was going to get a checkup from the neck up. A mental examination? I mean, why? It doesn't sound that much different than any other musician on their way to a gig, does it? Yeah, right. Anyway, when Wanda Lee Ann Podgursky, age 60, was convicted of 29 felony counts related to a million-dollar insurance fraud scheme, she fled before sentencing. She was sentenced in absentia to 20 and a third years in prison. Now, while on the lam, Wanda Lee registered a Twitter account and followed just one person on that service, District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis. She then tweeted to Dumanis, "Catch me if you can." Yeah, I saw that movie. He was caught, you know. Dumanis alerted the Computer and Technology Crime High Tech Response Team of the San Diego County Sheriff's Office, who quickly traced the account to Mexico. By then, our friend Wanda Lee had followed dozens of law enforcement agencies and followed up by tweeting, help find me before I con anyone else. U.S. Marshals simply went to the provided address in Mexico and arrested her and brought her back to serve her prison sentence. Again, 20 and a third years. It's interesting to note that even getting caught and convicted just wasn't enough to convince her that she wasn't as smart as she thought. Yeah. Meanwhile, here's a lovely story of young entrepreneurship. Don't you just love young entrepreneurship? It can start at a very early age. By the way, so can crime. In the absolutely most adorable incidents of moral corruption and social decay you'll probably ever hear this year, authorities say a 12-year-old boy in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, used a BB gun to rob a 10-year-old boy who was running a lemonade stand. Johnstown Sergeant Patrick Goggins said the 12-year-old approached the stand with what appeared to be a handgun in his pocket and threatened the younger boy. Goggins said the boys got into a wrestling match over the money box before the older boy took $30 and ran away. Wow, $30. That's one hell of a lemonade business. Anyway, three other children chased the boy home and helped police track him down. That is when police determined the boy had a BB gun. Police aren't identifying the suspect because he'll be charged in juvenile court, where most cases remain confidential. But the perp is only 12, so I'm sure we'll hear much more about him in about, oh, say, 6 years. His parents must be so proud. And finally, on this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Andy Hill, age 40, had just been released from the hospital after lung surgery and decided to take a nice, relaxing tubing trip with his wife in Montana's Clark Fork River. As they passed underneath the Bandman Bridge in East Missoula, however, another passenger joined them. The man had allegedly jumped from the bridge to float down the river and landed on Hill. "There was a guy on my lap," Hill said, "and he rolled off my lap and just kept apologizing. The impact broke both of Hill's legs, chipped both fibulas, tore the ACLs in both knees, and cracked his left femur. The man is facing criminal endangerment charges, and Hill will be confined to a wheelchair for weeks." Prior to the incident, Hill had been working to form a nonprofit agency called Fishabilities, which, Hill says, is meant to help people with disabilities get out on the water and go fishing. Boy, I gotta tell you, if Andy didn't have bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. That is just a sad story. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Memory expert Dave Farrow is back on the program. One of the things he's got going these days is the Canadian Memory Tournament. He's also working to combat what's known as the Summer Dumber Syndrome. And to explain what those are, Dave is on the line with us right now from Toronto. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being back on the program with us once again. So we're in the, as they say, the dog days of summer. And what exactly is Summer Dumber Syndrome?
Summer Dumber Syndrome. Well, this is our, you know, kind of a tongue-in-cheek way to approach a very serious topic. You know, parents are beside themselves because they've been observing this for years, but now we actually have some scientific data that I hope you're sitting down. This is not going to be a surprise to every common sense person out there, but the science has actually confirmed that kids actually get lazier and dumber over the summer. That part is obvious, we all know that, but we actually found that it actually affects their grades going into the fall. Students can decline as much as an entire letter grade if they don't do a couple of things over the summer. And actually, parents can be part of the problem or part of the solution. A couple of little things that I'm going to tell you during this interview will show parents things that they can do to prevent their kids from falling behind in the fall because they got lazy over the summer.
Now, I'm sure that anybody, any young person listening to this right now is thinking their radar is going off, going, oh gosh, this guy wants me to work during the summer too.
Well, you know what? There's a couple of things that you can do that don't feel like work. First of all, get into a bit of a routine. A lot of times during the summertime, kids just go out and do anything they want, do whatever. But, you know, if you just have something that even that kids, you know, want to learn, there's a lot of kids that get into hobbies that start fixing, I remember working on a go-kart when I was a kid. Right now I do some robotic stuff. But it's fun play stuff, but it's still mentally involving. But my suggestion to parents is do that at the same time every day. So once, say, 1 o'clock rolls around, you're going to do your hobby with your parents or on your own. And if you start to get them into that mindset that every day they do something, that actually has been shown to combat this kind of summer dumber syndrome more than almost anything else, because getting them into a schedule gets them feeling more like they're in school, even if they're only doing a half hour of, you know, a hobby.
Okay, I know this is slightly off topic, but when you just said that, a light bulb went off in my head and it got me to thinking, could you be also describing the same problem that retirees have?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Every time, there's a lot of studies on retirees on how there's a physical and mental decline across the board, except when, and I apologize to be the bearer of bad news if there's a retiree listen, but there is some good news, though. When they have an activity that they do, when they have activities like hobbies, gardening, whatever, travel, things like that, they tend to get into a routine where they do the same thing every day, because we as human beings, we need that routine. Our brain gets used to it, and then when we lose that structure, there's kind of this chaos that goes on, and it's really hard to get back into that kind of mindset of structure.
So when you're talking about, in the case of teens, you're talking about the summer dumber syndrome, you're saying, you know, don't waste the entire summer away, but by the same token, is there a period of time after you finish school where you kind of decompress and do nothing for a little while at least?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is why we're talking about this at the end of summer. You get a good point there. You don't need to do this throughout the whole summer and be the tiger mom type person. This is really something you'd want to do in August going into the first week in September. You want to get them into a routine, get them thinking about it, waking up at a regular time, going to bed at a particular time, that sort of thing, and that will improve their chances. I got a couple other tips. We've got short interview time here, but one of the other things that is really important when kids go back to school is to have a separate place set aside for doing studying or homework. A lot of times my recommendation is to have an actual desk that is just for studying and homework. There's lots of studies on memory. As you know, I'm the Guinness Book of World Records holder for memory. Every little edge counts when it comes to memory. Memory work is a big part of studying. I go to schools all the time and teach students all my, you know, cool secrets of memory techniques and stuff. But one of the simplest things that you can do is realize that location means a lot. If you're doing your homework at the kitchen table, if you're doing it in front of the television, the problem is not so much that there's distractions there, which is an issue for, especially for ADD people, but the other major problem by just doing your homework wherever, or doing it a different place all the time, or doing it at the kitchen table, is that you have so many other mental associations to that space. You're essentially telling your brain that, you know, I'm doing work now, but I can stop any time, and it's not a big deal. When you have a specific place that you do your homework or your studying or something like that, then every time you sit down, your brain thinks, oh, okay, now we get to work. This is work mode, and we don't do anything but work. And when you stand up and you go someplace else, then you're in another mindset. And it really does, we find out more and more that your brain pays attention to locations. I mean, this goes back to our old hunter-gatherer days. When you're in the forest, you're hunting. When you're in the field, you're gathering. When you're in the village, you're mixing or cooking or doing something else. And your brain associates these activities to these locations.
True confession, I did my homework as a kid at the kitchen table, and I was a terrible student. So there you go.
Well, there you go. There you go. And of course, and the third thing, obviously, and you know this, I'm a big proponent, use the latest brain science when it comes to memory. I of course, have one of the top systems called the Faro Method that teaches students how to cut their study time and remember more. It basically gets rid of all the memory issue in studying, so you can memorize hundreds of words of foreign language vocabulary in minutes. You don't have to use my system, but I do suggest that you look into it. The key here is, though, go with a memory or a study strategy, treating it like a skill set as opposed to exercises. Students don't need more work. That'll shut them down. You don't want to put them onto like Lumosity or some brain training thing. Their brains are not sluggish in that sense of, you know, comparing it to a middle-aged person who's just hasn't been exercising their brain. They are exercising their brain. What they need is a strategy to help organize information, to help organize it for tests, so that they're more focused on tests, so that they're better able to use their time. And that's why we call the FARO method a brain strategy as opposed to brain exercises.
Excellent. I want to talk a few minutes, because we have a few minutes left. I want to talk about the Canadian Memory Tournament. Oh, by the way, is something you're not only doing in Canada, but what exactly is the Canadian Memory Tournament?
Oh, my God. We have to do a whole segment on just this when we go back to school. But we're doing there's a whole bunch of clubs that are starting up in Canada. And actually, we originally intended it just for Canada. I'm partnering with Rick Green. He's one of the stars of the Red Green Show. He's a really good friend of mine and an expert on ADD. And we partnered to put together basically turning memory techniques into a game. Now, a lot of people know this. Some people don't. But, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records for memorizing 59 decks of cards all shuffled together, but I was not born with any special gift. This is a skill that anybody can learn, and I can teach in an afternoon or a few hours' time, any student can learn how to memorize a deck of cards, for example. Now, there's not a lot of courses in school that require you to memorize decks of cards, and I'm pretty sure card counting is not a course, but that what we're trying to do is we're using the game or the sport of memory tournaments and showing them all these cool little mental tricks that they can do to get them excited about study skills. So we have two phases to our memory clubs. Anybody who is in school now, anybody who is a parent or a teacher, you can log on to memorytournament.ca and you can start your own club. It takes 5 minutes, costs nothing. You can get a tournament manual that will show you all the cool tricks and how to actually play the sport. And you can get one of those for like $10, $15. We've got specials going on. We have affordable kits. And you can even donate a kit to a school of your choice, and you can encourage your alma mater to start these clubs. We want these clubs to start up all over Canada, but you know what? It went viral. We actually are in 7 different countries now, and we're just in the first month of our launch, just in the summer. And the goal of this is to have 100 different clubs in Canadian schools over the course of 2014. So I want to get every parent and teacher volunteering and getting them out there. Essentially, these after-school clubs are going to take your problem students and turn them into your top students by showing them the secrets of the brain and memory and all the latest neuroscience of learning. We start with the sport, and we're going to actually get some TV coverage for these tournaments. We're going to have competitions, regional and national competitions that will be covered, and we want to make students feel like stars for being smart, and that's why we're going with a sport on memory.
And you mentioned for parents, teachers, students, the website is memorytournament.ca, correct?
memorytournament.ca. It's just like a tennis tournament. Think of it that way, except no substitutes. But if people really want to find out more, they can look me up, Dave Farrow. You can Google that, or you can look up pushbuttonmemory.com, and that'll show them all the great things we have available for students. And I'm sure they can get a hold of me through your show, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now you're saying that you're doing a bigger push on the Canadian Memory Tournament with the beginning of the school year, right?
Yeah, really, this is supposed to follow over the arc of the school year. So we're going to start up all these clubs in September, October, and then as it gets further into the school year, we're going to have regional and then national competitions. We're going to end off with the national competition. And there is a plan for even an international competition. If people want to, if they get up to a certain level, they can actually go to New York and participate in an international memory tournament. So that's very exciting stuff.
So will you come back on the program in October and talk about it again and tell us how it's going with the Canadian Memory Tournament?
Absolutely. I will come back in September even and talk about it. I'll come back in your show anytime. I love you, man.
Excellent. Dave, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
All right. Thank you very much. And I know that we said a lot of websites and everything, and we're talking about memory. If you have a bad memory, don't worry. Push button memory. It's real easy to remember. Pushbuttonmemory.com, and then you can get a hold of me and all the stuff that we're doing, and you can find out everything from there. Just wanted to simplify it for people to go to pushbuttonmemory.com. Thanks a lot for the interview, man. This has been great.
Memory expert Dave Farro. Again, you can check out the websites he mentioned, including pushbuttonmemory.com, memorytournament.ca, and, of course, davefarro.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0208, and you'll find those very links we've just been talking about.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the Surf Lady. Plus, Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter. Of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news. As a matter of fact, more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, you know, I still can't understand some of these schools that will do the dumbest things in the name of zero tolerance. But here's the latest pinhead ruling. Second grader Josh Welch's two-day suspension in March was upheld on appeal in June by Park Elementary School officials in Anne Arundel County, Maryland, even though his offense was that he had nibbled a pastry into the shape of a gun, which he then waved around. Said Josh's attorney, if this school system can't educate a 7-year-old without putting him out of school, how are they going to deal with 17-year-olds? Good point. You know, it sounds like Josh's attorney is the only smart person in the room. I think it might also be a good idea for him to print up copies of his business card in bulk for parents in the Anne Arundel County, Maryland area, because over a period of time, they might just need his services when you consider the pinheads at the school board that they're dealing with. Anyway, in a similar vein, Michelle Hammack was overseeing her napping students at a child care facility in Arlington, Florida, when she smelled something burning. I just leaned over and peeked around, and there was a fire in the oven, she said, and I ran in there and opened it up to check and see if I could put it out, and then the fire alarm started going off. So she ran back, woke up her students, and got them outside, leaving them with another teacher while she went back inside to ensure no other children were in the building. When I got to the third classroom by the kitchen, I could see that it was just confined, the fire that is, to the oven. So she extinguished the fire, preventing it from spreading before the fire department arrived. Now for her actions, the facility's owner, Olga Roseyov, fired Hammack. Here's a quote. I fired her only because she left her room. Even though children are sleeping, the teachers are supposed to be there, she said. It's unacceptable. And if anybody else does the same thing, I will fire again. I will fire them. No question. Wow. You know, because apparently it's more important for the kids to learn to follow the rules than think for themselves when lives are actually at stake. Here's hoping Michelle will open her own daycare facility and the parents of the kids who are all at this one will all pull out of Olga's joint. That would be wonderful. Okay, now there's also a lot to be said for honesty. A woman intent on getting breast implants is begging for money on the streets of Pensacola, Florida, with a sign that reads, "Not homeless, need boobs." I just want bigger boobs because I'm not happy with the ones that I have. I figured this was a good way to do it, said Christina Andrews. People put out signs that they're homeless. I'm not, so I'm just being honest. Andrew said she's unsure what type of reaction she was going to get, but if she would just get any cash, then things would appear to be working out. She's not only getting more money, she's gotten plenty of smiles as well, she says. Well, you know, if she's getting a lot of smiles now, just wait until she gets her bigger boobs. And a man from Union, South Carolina, has been arrested after a neighbor accused him of smearing buttered toast on her SUV. Union County Sheriff's deputies say 34-year-old Christopher Brannon was arrested Saturday and charged with malicious damage to property. Authorities say a woman reported seeing Brannon wiping something on the back windshield of her SUV. The woman found a greasy film on the glass and a piece of buttered toast on the ground nearby. Brannon was arrested and released from jail on a personal recognizance bond. It wasn't known if he had an attorney. Damage to the SUV was estimated at $1. $1. 100 pennies. That's what the damage was listed as. Gee. And they gave him bond? My gosh. Anyway, a sheriff report did not mention a motive. Didn't mention a motive at all. I have no idea why he would do that. None whatsoever. But gee, he only used butter on the toast. Only butter. You mean there was no traffic jam? And finally, yeah, I know, it's a bad pun. And finally, on this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest. Diane Harvey, age 48, was arrested on August the 6th, and she was sentenced to 4 days in jail. According to the Houston Police Department, Harvey was intoxicated and was sitting next to a large cup of beer at around 4:05 p.m. on a downtown street. A mounted police officer on patrol told her to pour out the beer, which she then began to drink. According to HPD spokeswoman Jody Silva. Now, when the officer said that she would be arrested for public intoxication, she became irate and began to walk away, Silva said. The officer moved his horse to block Harvey's path, and she raised her arm and slapped the horse in the face. Yeah, just slapped the horse in the face. Now, trained not to react, the horse merely moved his head away. Wow. Wow. You know, personally, I would have loved if the horse had just looked at her and said, "Okay, that's one." The officer dismounted and handcuffed Harvey immediately. So, the horse is trained not to respond, huh? I doubt Diane knows that. And so, what was going through her booze-filled brain at that moment? I mean, if it wanted to, that horse could have just kicked her into next week. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Veronica Gray is known as the Surf Lady. She is also the author of Swim Without Sharks. Now, I thought it would be interesting to have her on the program to talk about sharks, since they always appear in the news around the time that the Discovery Channel has their Shark Week. So Veronica joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communication all the way from Hawaii to talk about some of the truths and myths about shark attacks. Hi, Veronica.
Good afternoon, Peter. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks for being on the program, too. In addition to talking about some of the myths and truths, I also want to talk a little bit about something that you created, which is like a shark repellent outfit.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I honestly was just on Good Morning America this morning, debuting it on national television for the first time. So it is a shark repellent wetsuit. And if somebody wanted to look for it, they can go to the website surfinguniverse.com and they'll see the clip of me on Good Morning America.
Right.
And so that's there for everybody to see.
Now, obviously, you spend a lot of time in the water, so you are in an area, I'm assuming, where sharks can be found. What are some of the biggest myths out there about sharks?
There's quite a few. One of the big ones I like to talk about is that sharks don't really have good sight, that they only can sense blood in the water. And that's not at all true. First of all, sharks' vision is 20 times more powerful than that of humans. And actually, that's the basis for the wetsuit. So the way the wetsuit is designed, it's really simple. Basically, it incorporates black and white stripes. And the reason for that is there's two reasons. Number one, the most venomous creature on Earth is the banded sea snake. It's just a black and white striped snake, but it has more lethal venom than any snake on land, more than the cobra, more than the rattlesnake, anything. If you're bitten by a banded sea snake, you die in about 8 seconds. So anyway, when sharks see black and white, they're reminded of a banded sea snake. It's been evolutionarily hardwired into their development. And so when I learned this, I thought, well, why not have black and white on wetsuits? And so that's one of the reasons the wetsuit was invented. The other reason it's black and white is because of also the way sharks see. Now imagine you're looking at a zebra that's black and white stripes. You see the zebra as a whole because that is how your eyesight processes it. Sharks will not see zebras as a whole. They would see a bunch of little black squiggly lines and a bunch of little white squiggly lines. They wouldn't see a whole zebra. They just see a bunch of black and white squiggly lines, each being its own separate thing. And so when a shark sees that, they don't think you're a good meal because you're too small to be a good meal. They're looking for something big and tasty like an elephant seal. And so they see the black and white, it sort of becomes disjointed. And so what they end up seeing is just a bunch of squiggly, disjointed things, and it makes you less likely to be targeted for a meal. The reason that people get bitten by sharks is not because sharks want to eat you. They're just testing to see what you are. So if they see a bunch of little black and white striped squiggly things, to them you're not even worth it. You're not big enough to be satisfying. And so that is why the wetsuit is black and white striped.
Okay. Now you are obviously you're known as the Surf Lady. First of all, how did you get the moniker the Surf Lady?
I fell in love with surfing in a way that nothing has ever obsessed me. And the first time I appeared on television just talking about surfing and the water and things like that was about 2 years ago. And as I started to appear on TV, my team thought it would be better for branding just to call myself the Surf Lady. And it's a lot easier to remember than the name Veronica Gray. Unfortunately, they were correct because my name Veronica, I get called all kinds of different things. People call me Victoria and Vanessa. But no one ever forgets the Surf Lady. So even though I feel like, okay, that's not really me, it's almost a cartoon character, I stick with it for the branding.
Now, you've learned over the years, obviously you've learned a lot about surfing, you've learned a lot about sharks, you have this wetsuit. So you're knowledgeable about what to do when you're in a situation where there are sharks. I would assume that a lot of people, once they see a shark, once they see that fin, the first thing that comes to their mind is panic. If you're in that situation, what do you do?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that because this is super, super important. And we give out this information for free on our website, swimwithoutsharks.com. So the reason I really just want to say that is I am going to tell you exactly the answer, but if people need to see it in writing to process it better, it's on swimwithoutsharks.com. So the last thing you ever want to do if you see a shark is to scream. And the reason is a shark will interpret that as a move of aggression. You know, it's kind of like you're yelling at them, you're kind of taunting them. So as hard as it would be, you need to keep silent. The second thing you need to do is never take your eye off the shark. Never turn your back on the shark. The reason is a shark's opening move when they go after prey is they like the element of surprise. They like it when the prey isn't looking. They like to attack prey from behind. So if you never take your eyes off the shark, if you never turn your back on a shark, you sort of take away their opening move. And without that opening move, they're at a loss. They don't know what to do. So basically, let's say you see a shark. You're not screaming. You don't turn your back on the shark. And you start to back away from the shark towards the shore as quickly and as efficiently as possible without ever turning your back on it. And I know people think, how are you going to do that? Well, you can do that by sort of walking or running backwards in place. We don't recommend swimming backwards in place because now think about it. The minute you're horizontal, which is a swimming position, it's a lot easier for a shark to bite one of your limbs. But if you remain vertical, standing straight up and down, think about how hard it is for a shark to bite you from that angle. They would have to sort of turn sideways to bite you from that angle. Whereas if you're horizontal, they can bite you very easily. So you want to back away to the shore while remaining as vertical as possible, back towards the shore, never take your eyes off the shark. Usually, once you do that, the shark will just leave you alone because you're no longer interesting. You've removed their point of entry. They're going to go find something else that they can attack. But if it looks like they're going to come at you, we do recommend that you do punch it anywhere you can. The nose, the eyes, the gills, it doesn't matter. Sharks have evolutionarily hardwired to avoid confrontation. That's why they are one of the oldest living creatures on Earth. They're older than trees, they're older than birds. They've evolved over 400 million years. And they don't like confrontation, believe it or not. People think, oh, they're this aggressive man-hunting creature. They're not. Actually, what they like to go after is sick or dying prey. That's just really easy.
Okay, so it sounds like they're just basically the bullies of the sea when you describe it that way. What I also wanted to know, we have this fear of sharks. Movies like Jaws and Sharknado don't help. But in reality, the number of shark attacks that take place, it's really low, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how you define that, Peter. There's one authenticated, unprovoked shark attack every 5 days somewhere in the world. However, how many of them turn out to be fatal is only 4 or 5 a year. So there's a lot of bites, but only 4 or 5 deaths a year. And not many people know this, but we kill 70,000 sharks a day.
And
humans kill 70,000 sharks a day. It's pretty ridiculous for their shark fins. And so compared to that, you know, who's the real monster?
Right. People can find out more information, as you say, by going to websites. You mentioned two so far, surfinguniverse.com and also swimwithoutsharks.com. And swimwithoutsharks.com is also the title of your book. And how can people find out more information about the swimsuit you're referring to, the wetsuit?
Well, because we just featured it on Good Morning America this morning, they should go to surfinguniverse.com because they'll get to see the Good Morning America clip. And as you know, Peter, a picture says 1,000 words. So they'll be able to see it in all its glory along with other great shark repellent products.
Excellent. Veronica, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Have a great afternoon, Peter. Thank you, too.
The Surf Lady, Veronica Gray. You can find out more about her by going to the websites she mentioned. That's surfinguniverse.com and swimwithoutsharks.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0208, and you'll find those very links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Last month, Detroit became the largest city in American history to file for bankruptcy. Detroit's financial problems can be blamed on corruption, massive pension liabilities, and a huge decline in tax revenue. Yet, there's another reason for Detroit's large deficits: personal injury lawsuits. The former chief operating officer of the Detroit Transportation Department recently revealed that a major expense for Detroit is the cost of personal injury lawsuits filed against the city. To make matters worse, he said Detroit's practice of settling virtually all lawsuits out of court is costing the city millions. The problem became so bad that his department tried to hire its own lawyers to fight these meritless lawsuits, but he was told that the city's law department would block the effort. Let's be fair, the Detroit experience should be a warning to all American cities. Excessive litigation has created what amounts to a lawsuit tax, and we're all paying the price. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, soaring to new heights, it is he, Stuart Nauman, and another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. We're going to, it's vacation time now, and, a lot of people are going away on different destinations, but I thought, hey, maybe we can go to the moon. And I don't mean the Ralph Cramden.
Oh, I was just about to ask.
No. Yeah. No. Too easy.
Yeah.
I don't think NASA would have approved.
Plus, we don't want to advocate, conjugal violence here.
No way.
Exactly.
But speaking of astronauts and wives and going to the moon and all that, from 1959 till 1972, the astronauts who made up the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo space missions for NASA were regarded by the American public and manufactured by NASA and the media as true all-American heroes. However, it was the astronauts' wives that had one of the toughest jobs of all. They had to be the model of calm, coolness, and glamour as their respective husbands were trying to fulfill President John F. Kennedy's mandate of landing a man on the moon by 1970, and yet facing the daunting prospect of not safely returning to the Earth after a mission. And they had to do this while they were constantly in the public eye. Now, basically, they were the ultimate trophy wives. Now, with the exception of the voluminous and extensive coverage from Life magazine and from Tom Wolfe's excellent 1979 bestseller about the Mercury program, The Right Stuff, not much has been written about what it was really like to be an astronaut's wife during the height of the space race of the 1960s. Now the story can finally be told in Lily Koppel's fascinating account, The Astronaut Wives Club. Now this book covers the 13-year period of the three significant NASA space programs and how the wives had to stand by their men no matter what the cost was to them and their families.
And in some cases, that cost was death.
Oh, yeah. In several cases. Yep. Not many, but there were several significant cases. Apollo 1, for example.
Apollo 1, yep.
Yeah. Now, the main argument that is emphasized by Koppel is that the club was more than just an excuse to have social outings and coffee clatches. It was established mainly as a support group because only the astronauts' wives could easily understand and empathize, with each other on the joys and hazards of having their husband dangerously explore such uncharted territory. Now, with that came the tremendous emotional toll of playing the role of being the perfect supportive wife to an adoring, worshiping public. They had to cope with their husband's long absences from their Houston homes. It was a little suburb they called Togethersville, to spaceflight training in Cape Canaveral, Florida, not to mention the constant partying, drinking, and philandering that went on, which ultimately led to many marriage breakups. The astronaut wives proudly took the brunt of their husbands' fast public lives as astronauts. For example, Susan Borman, whose husband Frank Borman flew on the historic Apollo 8 mission, became an alcoholic. Pat White, never fully recovered from her husband's tragic death in 1967 as part of the Apollo 1 mission and committed suicide in 1991. And Joan Aldrin personally witnessed her husband Buzz's gradual descent into a nervous breakdown during the glory and adulation he was receiving after the Apollo 11 mission that after returned to the Earth. But Koppel has done an exceptional job revealing the somewhat hidden aspect of the glory days of American space exploration, and with thorough research and interviews with many of the surviving astronaut wives. It's a perfect companion to The Right Stuff, and it proves that the wives were an integral part to the space race of the 60s and the quest to land a man on the moon, and should be appreciated as much as their astronaut husbands or the crew at the manned spacecraft center who helped guide them to and from outer space.
I'm willing to bet that even though you said earlier that they were under the scrutiny of the media of the day, I find it hard to believe that with as much media attention that they had, back in that time for what they were doing or what their husbands were about to embark upon, I don't think they'd be able to handle the kind of media scrutiny that we live under today under similar circumstances.
Oh, yeah. No, don't forget, this is 24-hour news coverage these days. Yeah. Back then, they only had one reporter that was basically falling around embedded with them, and that was a reporter from Life magazine, because they paid $500,000 for the rights to both the astronauts and the wives' stories.
Right.
So, yes, it was as intense, but maybe not as intense as it would have been today, actually.
Yeah, they would have dug into their backgrounds. It would have been, vile.
Well, yeah, I exactly. Think of. I mean, you probably would have had like Entertainment Tonight and Entertainment, Access Hollywood even there.
Yeah, but those are the legitimate media.
Yeah. You're talking about some of the bloggers and some of those online news outlets too.
And the tabloids, you know.
Oh, yes. And which weren't such a dominant, and tabloids weren't such a dominant force back in the 60s. I mean, everyone read the papers and also watched Walter Cronkite and read Life magazine.
Yep.
And that was, you couldn't go wrong with them.
Exactly.
Now, waiting for their husbands to arrive safely home from the moon may not have been a piece of cake like what Barbara Cernan said 40 years ago. Said that if you thought that, going to the moon was a piece of cake, you should try waiting for your husband at home. But their faith and inner strength during those long waits and how they gracefully handled it from liftoff to splashdown have made the astronaut wives the unsung heroes, or the unsung heroines, more like, of the space race. And this book, I think, is their permanent living testimony to the fact.
And the book is?
Called The Astronaut Wives Club by Lily Koppel, who I heard is Ted Koppel's daughter, actually.
Yes, yes.
And it's published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $31.
And you mentioned earlier that it would be a great companion to The Right Stuff, so I'm assuming that's one of the books you would consider adding to the reading list if somebody's looking for something in this vein?
Oh, yes, definitely. Right Stuff is a book that should be on top of that list. But also, let me mention a coffee table book called Moonfire by Norman Mailer. In 1969, Norman Mailer was commissioned by Life magazine to write the authoritative account of the Apollo 11 mission for the magazine. So it was never available in book form at all. It was just available in the magazine. So Taschen Books, which German company, which produces a lot of quality coffee table books, did a special edition of Norman Mailer's account called Moonfire, with a lot of great pictures of the Apollo 11 mission before, during, and after that historic July period in 1969. It is really something. I mean, space exploration buffs will really love this book. And like I said, it's available for the first time in book form.
Excellent. And so, again, the book was?
The Astronaut Wives Club by Lily Koppel, published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's only $31.
And how can people find you? I'm assuming you're still on the planet as opposed to, somewhere in the atmosphere.
No, I don't think you'll see me in Spam in a Can or by the Sea of Tranquility. No, you can see me in print in the West End Times or online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, and the clock is on. The clock is moving.
And Godspeed.
John Glenn.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have a few more Stuff File stories to get to before we get to our idiot of the day. Police are looking for a man who stole two puppies from an Orlando store on Saturday. It happened at around 6:45 p.m. at the Puppy Stop. Surveillance video captures a man taking an $800 pug from its crib and then shoving the dog in his pants. After walking out to his car and coming back in the store, the man does the same thing again with a $750 miniature dachshund. Eddie Rosario said the thief walked in with what appeared to be a decent family, another man, a woman, and a toddler. They used a kid to steal the dog. I mean, you come here and steal a dog with a kid? That's insane, Rosario said. Actually, that's kind of ingenious, but I digress. Another camera outside the store captures the group piling into what appears to be a dark-colored or silver Ford Crown Victoria with damage to the front end. The owner of the store, Charles Glass, said he's offering a $250 reward to anyone who has information that can lead to an arrest. Wow, shoving a dog down your pants, that's trusting. Very, very, very trusting. Anyway, stealing a pair of pants apparently wasn't an option in this next story. A 19-year-old man is charged with stealing a Bobcat front loader early Sunday morning and drunkenly attempting to drive it home. The suspect, Joseph Michael Hall, had a perfectly good explanation for it all, though, when authorities caught up to him shortly after 7 a.m. He was completely naked. Mr. Hall states that he was drunk and that he was trying to hide his nudity by taking the Bobcat, the arrest warrant states. The Bobcat was taken from out on a limb nursery. Authorities initially were alerted when a 911 call came in reporting that someone had smashed the Bobcat through a chain link fence at the nursery and had driven away with it. Hall was arrested less than a mile away, a few blocks from his own residence. The nursery's owner was called to the scene to retrieve the front loader. It's not immediately clear how the teen lost his clothes. Hall was being held at the Knox County Detention Facility in lieu of $6,250 in total bonds on charges of felony theft, public intoxication, underage consumption, misdemeanor vandalism, and indecent exposure. He has prior convictions in Knox County for DUI and assault. Well, he won't have to worry about clothes anymore. Hope he likes orange. And a man is facing weapons charges after a confrontation with his neighbor. Chris Amos with the Norfolk Police Department said the shooting occurred at around 7:30 p.m. Yes, a shooting was involved. The preliminary investigation revealed that Ronnie Jacobs, and he spells Ronnie R-H-O-N-N-E-Y. Anyway, Ronnie, who was 43, was speeding through the neighborhood when confronted by his neighbors. He returned to the area with a gun, and it discharged. Yes, he shot himself in the leg. No other injuries were reported. Jacobs was arrested and charged with discharging a firearm and brandishing a firearm. Feel free to laugh at Ronnie if you wish, as I'm sure every cop and most of his new cellmates are also doing. I was seriously considering making him the idiot of the day, but I did not. However, this next story does include an idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
Actually, this week it's double your pleasure, double your fun. We have two idiots for the price of one, with a common theme between them. Here at the Stuff File, we often talk about the hapless burglar or bank robber who inadvertently incriminates himself at the scene of the crime. Well, as I say, we have two more to add. Recently, here's the first one, Corey Harris, a defensive lineman for West Virginia University's football team, was arrested in July for a home invasion he allegedly committed while wearing his practice sweatpants emblazoned with his jersey number, which, by the way, is 96. Probably still higher than his IQ. And not to be outdone, police in Boston are confident that Zachary Tintoni is the man who robbed a woman in the yard of Harbor Middle School in June because as he grabbed her purse and fled, he dropped two bags he was carrying. Among the contents, his birth certificate and a letter from his mother. Yes, I'm sure she's proud. Anyway, why, oh why, would people commit crimes that literally incriminate themselves right at the get-go? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0208. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0208. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.